The following is an excerpt from the Science Magazine podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
David Graham, online news editor of Science Magazine, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about whether parasites lower your intelligence quotient, or IQ. Dave, how would this happen?
Well, Rob, the researchers blame it on something that they call the parasite stress hypothesis. It sounds really complicated, but essentially what it means is that when children grow up, as they fight off infections, their bodies have to expend a lot of energy to fight these infections. But when you're growing up, there's something else that requires a lot of energy to develop: your brain. It turns out your brain needs a lot of energy too. And the idea with this hypothesis is if your body's spending a lot of energy fighting off diseases, then your brain development is going to suffer, and hence your IQ is going to suffer along with it as you grow up.
First of all, though, aren't there higher incidences of parasites in poorer countries? And poverty might better explain intelligence levels?
Well, it's a good point, Rob. And there's actually a lot of things that could account for decreased intelligence. When another group of researchers published a very controversial study earlier this decade, they actually tried to estimate the IQ of various countries, over 100 countries. And as you sort of alluded to, Rob, they tended to find lower IQs in a lot of these more third world countries. And so one explanation is, well, maybe it's the poverty, maybe it's the lack of education. There's been other hypotheses that maybe it's linked to nutrition. You know, poor nutrition, your brain's not going to develop well.
The smarter people might tend to leave.
That could be a reason too. And so what the researchers tried to do in this new study was eliminate as many of these factors as possible. They went back to this study that had been done a few years ago, and they tried to see, could they find a factor that really explained the lower IQ? And they looked at a lot of things that we just talked about, nutrition and education and other things like that. And what they found was the strongest factor that seemed to be correlated with IQ wasn't any of these. It was how much infectious disease these countries deal with, things like malaria, other diseases caused by viruses and bacteria. It seemed like the countries that had the highest incidence of these infectious diseases also tended to have lower average IQs.
Any concerns about bias of IQ studies themselves, though? That they're geared towards people of certain cultures and not others?
Well, that's definitely one criticism of the study, is that the entire foundation of the study, which is IQ, is a very controversial topic. Some people say it has nothing to do with intelligence. And some people say, like you said, Rob, that the measure of IQ is very biased towards Western cultures or more developed countries, and that it puts people in other countries at a disadvantage. So to really start to buy into the results of this study, you first have to buy into the whole idea of IQ and that it's really an accurate representation of intelligence. But if you do buy into that, what the authors here are saying is, look, we really try to control for a lot of these other factors. And even after we do that, the strongest association we're seeing is between IQ and parasites.
So another argument for helping these countries to eliminate the high incidence of parasitic diseases.
Exactly.
Okay. So what other stories have we brought with you this week?
Well, Rob, from the geography of IQ to the mathematics of menopause, this next story is all about why there's only very few species on Earth that undergo menopause.
Besides humans, what else?
Besides humans, there's only two other species that researchers know of that undergo menopause, and they're both whale species. One is pilot whales, and the other is resident killer whales.
Do these two species of whale have something in common with us?
Well, that's what researchers have been trying to figure out. They have a hypothesis for why humans undergo menopause, something called the grandmother hypothesis. And the idea is that when a woman's young, it makes sense for her to keep on producing children because she's healthy and she can. But as she grows older, there's more dangers in having children. And at that point, it would ostensibly make sense for women to stop having children and instead start taking care of other children in the family, if they're living in a large extended family, say. It's just a hypothesis, though. And the reason researchers think this only seems to happen with humans and not most other species is that humans have historically had a very unique social structure when it comes to mating. What usually happened historically is when a woman was starting to have children, she would move in with the family of her male partner. And she's moving into this new family, and the idea is at first, the children are the only thing that's closely related to her in this whole family genetically, so it makes sense for her to be having children and be taking care of these children at first. But as the years go by and this family grows, she's getting more and more of her genes into this family via children and grandchildren, things like that. And so as she gets older, it starts to make sense for her to take care of the children of the family, because those children are now genetically related to her as well. But that doesn't explain why whales would also undergo menopause, because whales have a very different social structure than we do. They have something called pods, where a pod is sort of like a family unit of maybe 6 to 12 individuals. And what happens is when a female mates with a male, the female leaves her pod, the male leaves his pod, they mate. But then after they mate, they return to their respective pods, which is very unusual in the mammalian kingdom, and also very different from what happens with humans. So the hypothesis that researchers have posited for humans doesn't apply to whales. So this new study is all about, can researchers come up with some sort of mathematical model to figure out why these two species of whales would undergo menopause as well?
And what they find?
Well, what they found was that, sort of similar to this human situation, when a female would return to her pod and start having offspring, mathematically what the researchers show is as this female grows older, the genetics of the pod are such that although it all started out being her family in the first place, like it was with humans, she has a much higher degree of relatedness to subsequent generations than she had at first. And therefore, it makes sense for her to stop having children and start taking care of these other children. The idea, again, is from an evolutionary perspective, you want to make sure your genes continue to propagate in the gene pool. And originally, you do that by having children. But later on, you can also do that by taking care of children that are genetically related to you so that some of your genes continue to be passed on.
So for humans and these two species of whales, because of conditions or the environment or something like that, it's better for these females to stop having children and start taking care of the grandchildren, as it were, because there are more risks to them or something? Or,
well, that's at least the case in the human example. There's definitely more risk to having children when you're older. And therefore, if you're really interested in passing on your genes to future generations, the best way to do that isn't to have kids anymore, it's to take care of grandchildren that share some of your genes. And it's possible that something very similar is going on in whales, where at some point, from an evolutionary standpoint, it just makes sense for them to stop having their own kids. Thus, they undergo menopause. And this effectively forces them to start taking care of other children in their family group.
Do we know if pregnancy in whales is dangerous or risky?
It's a really good question, and that would draw further parallels with the human example. I don't know the answer.
Okay. Well, last story. What's this last one about?
Well, Rob, from the propagation of life on Earth to the propagation of life on other planets, this last story is about how there may be more extrasolar life out there than we had anticipated.
Where?
Well, Rob, this life would be on planets orbiting what are called M-dwarf stars. And these are stars that are a lot cooler than our sun. The problem is they're also a lot more violent. They tend to throw out these proton-rich flares, and they also create coronal mass ejections, which are these enormous outbursts of matter from the star. Not something you'd want to be really close to, but the problem is because these stars are so much cooler than our sun, which is what's called a G-class star, that any habitable planets would have to be much closer to these stars than they would be to our sun. And because they're closer, they're really right in this impact zone for these flares and these ejections. So astrobiologists, and these are scientists that study the possibility of life beyond Earth, have long assumed that these M-class stars are just not going to be very good for supporting habitable planets, because any planet that was potentially habitable that was too close to them would essentially be fried. And that's actually been a really big problem, because these M-class stars are really abundant in the Milky Way. Astronomers estimate that they may make up to 70% of the stars in our Milky Way. So right there, astrobiologists were saying, you know, that's 70% of stars out there that probably don't have habitable worlds, because they're essentially frying them, or frying their atmospheres at least.
So some kind of modeling to show that the effects of this radiation isn't quite so bad?
Well, exactly. What researchers did is they looked at one of these M-dwarf stars. It's a star called AD Leonis, or AD Leo for short. And this is an M-dwarf star that's about 16 light years from Earth. And researchers observed this star giving off a flare in 1985. So they have a lot of data about how powerful this flare was and how far it went. And what they did was they took this real life situation and they put a hypothetical planet into it. They created an Earth-like world and they had it orbit as close as it would have to orbit to this star to be habitable, to be warm enough to foster life. And it turns out 0.16 astronomical units, and that's essentially half of Mercury's distance from our own sun. So you're talking about a very close proximity to the star that they put this hypothetical world. But despite this proximity, and despite the fact that this AD Leo star was throwing out this really powerful flare, the researchers found that not only did this flare not vaporize this Earth-like planet's atmosphere, as they had been concerned about, it actually reinforced the atmosphere. This planet they created had an ozone layer, much like our ozone layer. And ozone is O3, oxygen is O2. And what the researchers found is that the energy from this flare was actually creating a lot more of this O3. So it was actually building up the ozone layer rather than destroying this planet's atmosphere. And the ozone layer is what on Earth protects us from UV radiation and makes life possible.
Are the people who are looking at how planets form around stars saying that such a planet could form around one of these M-class stars?
Well, that's what astrobiologists have been saying all along, that, you know, there's so many of these M-class stars out there that they're just bound to have planets like Earth, maybe not exactly like Earth, but potentially the same size, and potentially rocky worlds like our world, which astrobiologists think is needed for life. There's so many of these stars out there that they've got to have worlds like this around them. The question all along has been, would these worlds really be habitable because of all this violent solar activity? And now, at least according to this study, which admittedly is just a model, it shows that these planets could indeed support life despite being in the quote-unquote danger zone.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we've got a story about how making friends can actually help you live longer, at least in baboons, and also a story about how studying ostrich movement may give us a clue to how dinosaurs moved. And also on Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we continue to follow the oil spill. We have 5 questions about the science of the oil spill. Where is the oil going? What's happening to it? Stories this week about a prize that may be offered for somebody who comes up with the best idea for how to clean up the oil, and also what's happening with vulnerable sea turtle eggs. And also on Insider, we've got a story about chronic fatigue syndrome. This is a very controversial area because a lot of people think that chronic fatigue is caused by a virus. And there's actually a study that came out to support this. There's another study that refutes it. And this is really important for blood bank donations, because some blood banks have said, well, if you've got chronic fatigue syndrome, you shouldn't donate blood because you may have this virus. So a very controversial, very interesting area with potentially very important policy implications. Be sure to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.